Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet,
sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Again, welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today, I have Robert. He's going to talk about his new book, The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar Cartel. If you have any questions of him, please give us a call at 347-324-3460, 347-324-3460, or you can post a question in the chat room and I'll go ahead and read it on the air. Walt, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me back.
Robert, didn't want to mispronounce your name. Forgot to ask you before we went on in 3 minutes. Is it Mezer?
Yes, Mezer.
Okay, great. But thank you. I really appreciate it. I guess that to begin with, kind of tell us about yourself, and then we'll segue into how you wrote the book.
Sure. Well, I was a federal agent for 27 years, and during that time, the majority of my time I spent working on investigations that relate to international drug trafficking and money laundering. After working for more than a decade, we came to the conclusion that the most effective way to really infiltrate or to identify and prosecute the command and control of these major organizations was to use the long-term undercover technique. So I volunteered to become a long-term undercover agent. I went through undercover training. I was extraordinarily fortunate. I was trained by some of the best former undercover agents in the country, including Joe Pistone, the former FBI agent that the movie and the book Donnie Brasco is based upon. But that training includes psychologists that are involved in vetting the candidates to make sure that they only allow those individuals who at least they feel score out in such a way psychologically to handle the pressure cooker of living a double life. And so after I finished that, I spent about a year and a half putting together a sophisticated front. I emerged from that with a completely new identity, embedded in active businesses, including an investment company, a mortgage company, an air charter service with a private jet, with a jewelry chain with about 70 locations on the East Coast, and even a brokerage firm with a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. So I didn't have to be the best undercover agent to come across as the mob-connected money launderer that I portrayed to be from New York. I also had two guys within one of the five New York crime families that were informants vouching for me on the street. So with that, I began to work with some of the lower-level members of the cartel through informants and through other undercover agents. And after a period of 2 years, I've worked my way up to the point of working immediately with many of the direct reports of Pablo Escobar, including his principal consigliere, a lawyer by the name of Santiago Uribe, who to the rest of the world was a professor at the University of Medellin, a practicing lawyer, a guy who dealt with the legislature, but in reality he was one of the higher-ranking members of the advisors to the company. He was involved in global money laundering plans, and he was also involved in meetings deciding who would live and die on a given day. I spent the better part of the 2 years working directly with people at the top. I became a conduit for them to the international banking community and business community, which unfortunately markets this type of money. There's roughly $400 to $500 billion a year generated from the sale of illegal drugs around the globe, $65 billion from the United States. So that's a very, very lucrative market for people who want to capitalize on it. As a money launderer, I was a part of what's called the black money market. And we could make, just like any business, you have supply and demand clients, and my supply clients supplying me dollars were drug cartels. And the demand side, where people wanted to buy those dollars, were importers in countries that didn't have the U.S. dollar. Because if you want to buy goods in the open market internationally, you need U.S. dollars. You can't go with Colombian pesos to Dubai and buy container loads of goods in their free zones or go to China or Panama to do that. So I could make 15% from the drug dealer who was looking for other currencies and 10% from the importers. who were looking for dollars. So I, on volume of a $1 million deal, I could make as much as 250 grand. So that's a pretty lucrative business, and there are also international banks that are looking for larger amounts of deposits to increase their balance sheet. So I became a part of that, and when we ultimately decided to take the case down, which we did with a fake wedding, of that was supposed to be my wedding, and we drew people in from Pakistan, from Colombia, from Panama, from the UK, from France, from around the United States, and that was the takedown in the case, which really started to work. I worked for 2 years after that, getting ready for trials, and 3 years after that, testifying around the world. But in a nutshell, that's what the book addresses, that experience, what it's like to live a double life, what it's really like inside these cartels.
Wow. So if we go back for a step, kind of tell us who is Pablo. I know he's a part of this cartel in South America. Can you tell us about why is he really significant? Is he the main person in South America that controls everything, or are you just one of a dozen?
Well, at the time, Pablo Escobar was the wealthiest man on Earth, and he was the most powerful drug lord on Earth. The Medellin cartel was clearly had a reputation of being the most violent cartel. What you see happening now in Mexico was an everyday affair for the Medellin cartel. He tried to influence the legislature, the judicial system. He had judges killed with no thought whatsoever. People in the media, people in law enforcement, in the military. There was one individual running for president in Colombia before Pablo was killed. There was one individual running for president that was thought to be on a particular commercial airline. When Pablo got word of that, he caused a bomb to be planted on the plane. The candidate wasn't there, but he still had the, not knowing that, and he had the plane blown up in midair. So more than 100 people lost their lives, innocent individuals who were just traveling from one city to another in Colombia. So a lot of what we see the Mexican cartels doing today is really a following the same road that Pablo Escobar pushed. He pushed too hard. One of my main clients was his principal manager, a guy named Gerardo Moncada. And Moncada controlled about 60% of Pablo's routes. And unfortunately, he decided to try to steal some of Pablo's money. He had the entire basement of the house filled with cash that was discovered. When that happened, Escobar had him and his brother brought before him. They were hung by their feet. Their clothes were stripped off their bodies, and blowtorches were used to melt the skin off their bodies. So that's the type of day-in, day-out type activity that Pablo Escobar was known for. And that was a watershed event when he killed the Moncadas, because it caused a vigilante group to emerge from within the cartel called Los Pepes, the people persecuted by Pablo. And it was they who then declared war on Pablo. And any time, anywhere, they could find a member of the cartel, the Medellin cartel, they massacred them or got their cooperation to try to find Pablo. And ultimately, with the help of the Cali cartel, a competing cartel, and the Colombian military and law enforcement and some intelligence community resources, and some argue possibly even some of the U.S. state's federal law enforcement, but I think that's denied in law enforcement corners, but They banded together, hunted Pablo down, and he was killed in 1993.
Yeah, I see you in 1993, the young age of 44. So, is out of all the people in the world, would you say he's probably one of the most ruthless person, I guess, cartel member ever?
I would say so. You know, he was a very smart marketing man, though, too. He tried to assume the role of Robin Hood. He gave many millions of dollars to the poor by building public housing. So he grew, he cultivated a grassroots support within the Colombian people, which is part of the protection that he had because of his outward-fearing as being a nice guy, when in fact, you know, that was really all done, in my view, for them to get some protection, and not really done out of the goodness of their hearts.
Okay. And we have a caller on hold, and I'm going to take that call in a few minutes.
Okay.
Just go back to another thing real quick. your experience as a drug agent, what type, you mentioned the training, and you're a federal, is it a DA agent or you're an FBI agent, or is it DA?
The Drug Enforcement Administration is the agency I retired from. Before that, I was with what's called the U.S. Customs Office of Enforcement. That's known as the Department of Homeland Security now, their Immigration and Customs section. So those were the two of the agencies that I was with that I did most of this long-term undercover work on.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take a call, and then I have some more questions I want to go ahead and ask.
Okay.
You. Okay.
Sure.
Caller, you're on the air. You can ask a question.
Hey, okay, good. This is for Robert. How much truth is there to the assertion that the CIA and or the banks have an influence or control the drug money either going in, coming in or going out of the United States?
Sure. Well,
let's
address both issues. First, let's start with the banks. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind, and I've written papers about this that and articles that have been printed in the New York Times, as well as papers that I've submitted to respected educational organizations like Cambridge University, Jesus College in Cambridge, where I've pointed out what I believe is a very consistent pattern of international banking community getting this type of money. You know, we don't have to look back to the case that I was involved in, but I'll just quickly mention it. You know, the case I was involved in, it was the Bank of Credit and Commerce International that I dealt with. It was the seventh largest privately held bank in the world. It had offices in 72 countries, more than 15,000 employees. It had a definite, clear goal to market money from the underworld. As they explained it to me, they marketed flight capital. That could be money from just about any one of certain sources that was seeking secrecy from governments. So it could be drug money, it could be from arms dealing, it could be from evading customs duties, tax evasion, it could be people pilfering treasuries in third world countries, it could even be the intelligence community wanting to move money from one part of the world to another without other governments finding out about it. But there is a skill set that the international bank community uses in order to affect that type of movement. My monies were moved probably through seven different major haven locations, totally disguised. You would have never been able to find it if it weren't for the fact that I was recording conversations with these guys over a period of 2 years. 1,200 recordings that were made in the undercover operation by me and my partner. And that was the cornerstone for the prosecution of the senior management of the bank. Many of them went to prison. Because it was unequivocal. We had it on tape. We could prove that they knew where the money was coming from. They solicited it. They worked with other drug dealers. We were able to prove after we did the search warrants of their bank offices in London, in Paris, and in the United States. So, but you don't have to go back that far. You don't have to go to exotic banks. BCCI had offices in the United States, but they were based in Luxembourg. You can go to other banks and see admitted criminal conduct in connection with the solicitation funds that are identified as drug proceeds. We can look at a case just in 2010. One of the biggest banks in the United States, Wachovia Bank, in March of 2010, entered into what's called a deferred prosecution with the Department of Justice. A deferred prosecution, in my view, is a slap on the wrist. What it amounts to is the Department of Justice saying, here's an information, which is similar to an indictment, we are going to file... We filed a criminal charge against you, but we're going to give you the opportunity to do the right thing, to improve your conduct, to not do this type of criminal conduct, and pay a fine. And in return for that, after we prove you've done that for a year, then we will allow you to pay the fine, and the indictment or the information will be dismissed. And that's exactly what was done with Wachovia Bank. They solicited deposits totaling $400 billion from account holders in Mexico during the years 2004 to 2007. That's a heck of a lot of money. That's one-third of the gross national product for Mexico for an entire year, a country whose per capita income is $4,000 per person. Now, among the services that they provided, they brought back into the United States by the admission of their own deferred prosecution, and your listeners can just Google this, Wachovia bank deferred prosecution, and they'll find the deferred prosecution that spells this out. Among other things, they brought $14 billion in bulk currency back into the United States. And I say back because I was a money launderer in another undercover capacity. I can tell you a lot of that money was generated on the streets of our major cities from drug trafficking and smuggled down to Mexico, given to houses of exchange, casas de cambio, to make it look legitimate. And then Wachovia got a hold of the money and moved it all over the world. The $14 billion they physically brought back, imagine that. This is money shrink-wrapped on pallets. This is money brought back in armored cars and flown back into the United States, brought through what the bank calls bank verification notes, which is nothing more than counting houses in California. Then the money gets put into the Federal Reserve, and it turns into wire transfers and gets sent all over the world. Much of that money, $110 million of it, was traced directly to huge planes that were used to ferry cocaine around the world, known because they were either seized or with cocaine on. So, and in return for all of that, and the admission of guilt and the deferred prosecution, Wachovia, nobody went to jail. They paid a $160 million fine. That was 2% of their profits for the year before from which the fine money was paid. To me, that doesn't speak well. There are many, many other cases similar to that that are deferred prosecutions that have occurred in this country, probably 10 or so, and I name them in the articles that I've written. So I think the Banking on Terror was one of the articles. Your listeners can Google Banking on Terror in my name. And I forgot which one was in the New York Times, but you can find that there, and it lays out the statistics and the specifics of those cases. You know, when it comes to the intelligence community and their involvement, let me just make this comment. The bank that I dealt with was owned by Saudi intelligence. In most part, when I say that, I mean the former head of Saudi intelligence was a major stockholder. The guy who managed my account at BCCI, a guy by the name of Amjad Hawan, his father was previously the head of the ISI, which is the equivalent of the CIA in Pakistan. So, and the bank was used in some respects to divert money to the ISI so they could do off-book black ops that were not on their books. That's where they got some of their funding from. And when it comes to the CIA, I know there's been a lot of reports of that kind of accusation, and certainly when it relates to Oliver North, there's been a lot of allegations about drugs for arms and drug money being generated in the Iran-Contra matter. I didn't personally see that with respect to the CIA. And you have to recognize, too, that many times intelligence agencies use informants. Informants are very difficult animals to control. Sometimes they get out of control. And sometimes what they do becomes painted with a broad brush with the agencies that they were affiliated with. So I can speak to the ISI and the Saudi intelligence, but I never personally saw it with regard to the CIA.
Okay, we're going to take another question real quick. Caller, you're on the air.
Okay, good. You had mentioned the Federal Reserve, too. Let me make this a simple. I don't think I phrased the question the way I want to before. Let's say there's $1 trillion either coming in or going out due to drug money from the United States or into the United States. What percentage of that $1 trillion is either controlled by or allowed by the CIA in conjunction with any other federal agency, such as the Federal Reserve?
Thank you.
Maybe you can help me to understand this a little bit better. Are you talking about how much of it is laundered through government undercover operations, or help me to understand your question better, unless our host can do that for
me. All right. $1 trillion of drug money. How much of it, what percentage, would be controlled by the CIA, either controlled by them, known by them, operated by them, or allowed to operate inside and outside of the country by the CIA in conjunction with the Federal Reserve or any other federal agency?
Okay, and you're talking about them being knowingly involved in the movement of this money, not for the purposes of making cases, but for the purposes of generating revenue and
right, for themselves,
and,
right.
Yeah, for themselves. You know,
okay.
I can't say because, you know, I can only tell you about the cases that I've tried to expose that show to me clearly that there's an element within the international banking community that wants to deal with this type of money. One of the topics of my articles have been that we need to be more aggressive in within our law enforcement community to get access to the information that's maintained by the Federal Reserve. Because the Federal Reserve actually has tons of information about the currency that's repatriated from different banks around the world into the Federal Reserve so that it is then turned into bank balances and wire transfer. You know, if we just follow the money, the bulk cash that's coming back, a very large percentage of the bulk cash is related to underworld activity. So if
wow.
if you're a country, if you are, and I can give you a clear example of this, Lebanon, and I think it was between 2008 and 2009, or 2009-2010, but in one of those years, the amount of U.S. currency being repatriated to the Federal Reserve from the central bank in Lebanon doubled. I think it went from somewhere like $9 billion to $18 billion. That's a red flag. Why is all that money coming in from there? And shortly after that, the Drug Enforcement Administration and military and intelligence community, working not just in our country but in other countries, were able to identify that there was a particular bank called the Lebanese Canadian Bank that was principally responsible for sending huge amounts of U.S. currency back into the United States. That money, after being tracked, was tied to the profits of an organization working closely, a Colombian-Lebanese drug organization, not just the Colombian cartels working in that, but also the Mexican cartels and Hezbollah. You can look at, your listeners can Google the name, Juma, J-O-U-M-A-A, and
okay.
money laundering. And that is the case that I'm now talking about. In that particular case, $200 million a month was being laundered. 85,000 kilos went to Los Zetas in Mexico, the most violent drug cartel there. Had we gotten the information, had somebody at the Federal Reserve said, oh, gee, we better get in touch with federal law enforcement. Look at this. We've got a big red flag on our radar zone. Why is all this money coming from this particular part of the world? It seems strange to me that we have to knock on the door and beg for records and information that Federal Reserve at times argues is proprietary, rather than it being something where we're being told by them where this money is being collected from in great detail. You know, they can get the information. They can get the information to us about that type of cash move, but that would be very helpful. Does that mean that they knowingly want to take this? I can't say that.
Okay. Now, the United States, I mean, we're a powerful country. We can have control of what comes in our ports. Why the government is not doing that? I mean, we have money. We can build teams to pretty much do anything we want to do. We can control commerce. We can do anything. So why we have this issue of money coming through our system? Is it they turn a blind eye? The bankers do what they want. Federal Reserve just sitting at the desk and just watching all these funds come through. I mean, I'm sure if it's in a certain range, they're going to suspect something's going wrong. Or is they just not, I'm not going to say they really don't care. It's just they just letting it flow. And maybe they want to build a case on it. But, you know, cases takes 2 or 3 years to really develop. Why our country, why our country is allowing this?
Well, you know, we say things like our country, you know, but it all boils down to individuals. And, you know, there are some very, very brave and dedicated people within the law enforcement community that I personally know and work with who fight that type of fight every day. I also have come across bankers who have blown the whistle on situations, people, compliance people within international banking institutions have blown the whistle. But, you know, there's also a segment that's very, very motivated by sales. The compliance departments are responsible to see that everybody dots their I's and cross their T's. But the salespeople, the business line, they get their compensation based on how much in deposits they bring in. And sometimes individuals make very selfish decisions that ultimately create these types of scenarios. When I say that there are brave men and women out there, I personally deal with a section of the Drug Enforcement Administration called the Special Operations Division. I know these people. I deal with them. I've spoken to them as recently as this morning. And they are the ones who have made cases on things like the Lebanese Canadian Bank, the Juma case, even a case on an arms dealer by the name of Victor Booth, B-O-U-T, another one your listeners mm-hmm. should look at, the biggest international illegal arms dealer in the world that they took down and wound up extraditing or getting extradited back into the United States, a guy who was tied closely to the KGB, the Russian Army. He was supplying arms to terrorist groups in the Middle East, in Africa, in South America, and they put that case together. Why was he allowed to operate for decades the way that he was? Well, he had the protection of the KGB, he had the protection of certain governments that were very thankful that he was creating havoc for the Western world. Unfortunately, politics sometimes gets into this, and greed gets into this. You know, we can only make
Absolutely.
These cases one at a time. As long as we have people who believe in the concept that they work for the people. I worked for the government, but I never felt like I worked for the government, this mythical controlling thing. I always felt as though I worked for the people. That's who put mm-hmm. their trust in giving me the responsibility I had as an agent. So if I could look my neighbor, my family, my friends in the face and say, you know what, I did the best damn job for you today that I possibly could, then I was doing my job. Not whether I made my bosses happy, got them promotions. I needed to do the right thing. The more people mm-hmm. within government who have that philosophy, and I'm not saying that I'm the only guy that had that feeling. There's lots of people who have that feeling, but it takes a lot of courage sometimes to stand up to people who don't want you to do the right thing. I never became a manager. I stayed on the street. I thought that if I could ever make a difference, it would be by staying in the trenches and fighting as close to crime as I could possibly get involved. Some people feel like getting up in management is the way to go. I just thought that took me too far away. But there are a lot of people out there that have that. And, you know, that's the good thing. I'm one of many, many, many people, a major portion of the law enforcement community that feels this way. So even though it's frustrating, even though we hate to hear these things, and even though these are ugly facts, the more light we shine on them, the more we talk about them with one another, the more we write about it, the more we force people's faces into it, the more likely it is that we'll get more people to do the right thing. And that's all we can do. We just got to fight the fight one step at a time.
Okay. A couple of things real quick. Regarding the risk of the agent and these type of scenarios and to their families, are there inherent risk to the agent and their families these type of operations?
Absolutely. Right around the same time that I was doing long-term undercover, a very brave soul by the name of Enrique Kiki Camarena, a former mm-hmm. DEA agent, was working in Mexico. Among other things, he was one of the principal people responsible for the destruction of about $1 billion worth of marijuana fields that were in Mexico. This was being done by a cartel that it was clearly known had influenced the government, had influenced the military, had influenced law enforcement, and all of those people were very, very concerned how much the United States knew about that corruption. Unfortunately, one day as he was leaving the consulate office, he, in Guadalajara, to meet his wife for lunch. He was kidnapped on the street by five men. One of them was showed credentials as a Mexican police officer. He was taken to a location where there was a doctor who administered drugs to him to keep him awake, to feel 48 hours of constant torture, torture that is unspeakable. That session was recorded. And so there's unequivocal proof of what it is that had occurred. A month later, his body was found in a shallow grave. The kind of sacrifice that he and his family have made in these issues is the greatest sacrifice that anyone could possibly make. He's not the only person who's given his life in this fight, but he certainly is someone that we can't forget. And anybody who works this type of job, and not just the long-term undercover. I mean, you could be involved in other types of activity, you know, supporting these cases, and you carry a heavy risk. So, it's a tragedy, but it's something I hope your listeners won't lose sight of.
Now, when it comes to a person going undercover
in a foreign country and their families are here, any inherent risk to their families here in this particular country?
You mean, are their families in this country at risk?
Well, and they, you know, are they at really at risk, even that the agent's undercover some other place? I think you mentioned with your particular case, you know, they wrote your credentials this particular way and down to your wedding, and I'm sure that everything was staged. However, they gave you a different identity then versus to kind of mean your family. I'm assuming that your family was here in the States. And,
yeah, they were. Well, at the end of the undercover operation, a contract was issued on my life by certain members within the Medellin cartel. That was verified by the Drug Enforcement Administration as well as one of the intelligence agencies in the United States. I, my family, my wife and two children were whisked out of the country. I signed over powers of attorney for my home to be sold. We were out of the house in 48 hours, came back using another identity, and tried to relive the life, a very secluded life for many years, and there was a clear danger that they faced, all because of the type of work that I was doing. So, yeah, it is something that can affect them even though they're not in a foreign country.
Okay. Regarding the risk, do you think really out of all these particular issues, should narcotics just be legal in that country like some other countries, then maybe that will stem the tide of all these issues going on? Is that a easy solution? I mean, some countries deal with it. They have more control, like the Netherlands.
I'm going to have to leave shortly, but here's the deal. You know, I think that we've come to a time when the brightest of minds on both sides of the argument about cannabis should be having a debate, and we should be looking from a nationwide basis, not just having medical marijuana in California, but, you know, I think across the board it's something that either, you know, we need to determine makes sense or doesn't make sense. But when it comes to the issues like methamphetamine and crack cocaine, these are unbelievable drugs that will steal your soul and your mind with minor exposure to it. People argue, well, if you legalize it, it'll take the profit out of the cartels. No, it won't. Who's going to be providing those drugs then? Are we going to then turn to pharmaceutical companies that are going to produce it, and what price are they going to set on it? What is going to keep a black market from evolving that would be undercut by the cartels? Do I really want my neighbor being able to manufacture methamphetamine, a volatile chemical that can blow up my entire city block, if it's not dealt with properly? It's very, very volatile. I don't want my grandkids and my kids having any more ready access to these types of drugs than are already out there. What I think the answer is something that we ignore, and that is we ourselves, looking in the mirror and admitting to ourselves that our insatiable appetite for illegal drugs is a serious portion of the problem. You can't just say no to drugs. That's not going to resonate with the youth of today. Let's get more science-based. Let's get some more factual stuff. And let's spend some time really mentoring. And I don't care if we win one child at a time. We've got to educate those areas, those segments of our society that are most susceptible to the use of illegal drugs, and begin to get that education out there. Once we've really, really done that, then possibly we can start to talk about other ways to remedy this on the supply side. But we really, really need to deal with it on the demand side. It's out of control.
Great. Well, we're going to leave it at that. A word to get your book real quick, your title of the book, My Secret Life?
The title of the book is The Infiltrator. And there's a website for the book. It's called the-infiltrator.com, www.the-infiltrator.com. You'll find all the information you want about it. And we're also in a movie development deal now, and hopefully we'll be able to get that off the ground sometime over the next year or so.
Perfect. And it's available also on Barnes & Noble and Amazon?
Sure. When you go to the-infiltrator, there's a tab that says where to buy. That'll give you the links to Amazon, Borders, Books a Million, all the major book distributors that you can buy it from.
Okay, great. Well, we'll leave it at that. Again, it's Robert Mazur. Thank you for joining the program.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye.
Great. Take care. Again, this has been another production of Apple Capital Group, The Core Business Show. You can download this show on iTunes, on Blog Talk Radio Network. Everybody have a great day. Take care. Thank you. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to The Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.